From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. News this week of a rare fanged deer spotted for the first time in decades. Creatures throughout the whole animal kingdom can have impressive weapons, from porcupines to fiddler crabs to dung beetles. Our guest today says these features can evolve through biological arms races that parallel humanity's own military history. Plate armor, gunpowder, even nuclear war. This hour on Point. Animal weapons, animal arms races. You can join us on air or online. Why do you think humans are so fascinated by the natural weaponry of animals? From a 10-point buck to a saber-toothed cat in the museum. Have you wondered how they came to be? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me this hour from Missoula, Montana, is Douglas Emlin, professor of biology at the University of Montana. His new book is Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle, and you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Doug Emlin, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So when you talk about the evolution of animal weaponry, specifically, what are you referring to?
Well, weapons come in all shapes and sizes, but I have to confess at the outset that for me, it's always meant the really big stuff. I guess as long as I can remember, I've been obsessed with the really, really big weapons. Things that you look at these animals and they look like they should tip over or collapse under the bulk and weight of these structures. And so although there are all sorts of chemical weapons and any type of animal you think of has claws or teeth of some sort, the weapons I'm really here to talk about are the extremes.
So what was the fascination? You talk in the book about your curiosity with animal tusks and horns and all manner of weaponry at the Natural History Museum when you were a kid. What was it?
I do think these passions run deep. And it's hard to put a finger on. As a biologist, it became pretty clear for me pretty fast, though, that I was fascinated by things that look like they shouldn't be possible. Mm-hmm. And so I started pouring through crazy structures in animals. And pretty quickly, if you do that, you end up converging on the things that we call ornaments and weapons of sexual selection. So the gaudy characteristics of males that either serve as a display to attract females, so huge bird tails, peacocks with their enormous plumes, or weapons. And for me, it's been weapons ever since. There are so many species out there with these crazy structures on them. And so many of them, we know so little about them. It's uncharted territory. Mm. So I guess I've been fascinated by them all along. But the more I dig, the deeper I dig, the more blown away by these structures I become.
So give us more examples of the crazy weaponry that you say shouldn't be possible.
Well, so we often take some of these things for granted. I live in Montana, which happens to be a great place for weapons because we've got bull elk with enormous racks on their heads all around us and bighorn sheep smacking their heads up on the mountainsides. And I guess as a culture, we grow up sort of exposed to these things either directly or through photographs and artwork. And so we almost take them for granted, but these structures are huge. But for me, what really amazed me are the insects, because a lot of times these animals are ones that we don't pay attention to, we don't think about. Sometimes they're even underfoot. And I spent many years looking at dung beetles, of all things. Talk about your sort of inglorious beasts. And we really do take them for granted. But if you're willing to get down on your hands and knees and look at these things and you look at them close up, the weapons on some of these beetles would put an elk to shame. They're bigger and bolder and more dramatic relative to body size, or ounce to ounce, so to speak. The weapons on a dung beetle are often more spectacular than the weapons that we'd see on an Irish elk or a living elk.
Okay, describe them. You've built this up for me. Describe them. What are they?
There are many I could describe. In fact, I got to say I have one with me crawling up my arm, although this guy's not a dung beetle. He's a rhinoceros beetle, which is one of the beasts that we work on most closely in my laboratory right now. Mm. So this is an Asian rhinoceros beetle, a giant Asian rhinoceros beetle. That's actually what it's called, the giant Asian rhinoceros beetle. He's probably almost 2 inches long, so shaped roughly like an apricot, if you will. And then he has a horn coming off of his head that's another inch and a half long, so almost as long as the rest of his body. And imagine having a pitchfork sprouting off the top of your head. So this thing projects straight forward from between his eyes in front of his body. And after about an inch, it arcs outwards and splits into two tines, which then split into two more tines. So the result is really a lot like a pitchfork. It's this four-tined prong that weighs a third of his body weight sticking off the top of his head. Mm. Beautiful beast. I'm biased, but these guys are pretty cool.
So why do some species develop extravagant weapons, as you call them, while others do not?
So this is the question. And the simple answer is that these are structures that males use in species where there's intense competition among males over access to females. But that answer is too easy because there's lots and lots of animals out there that face intense battles among rival males. And only a fairly small subset of them has sort of launched onto one of these trajectories that we might call an arms race and led to bigger and bigger and bigger weapons. And so for me, after spending a bunch of years studying sort of the genetics and the development of these structures, I had a chance to step back and start looking through the literature on all kinds of animal weapons, antlers in flies, antlers in deer or elk, horns in African antelope, tusks in mastodons, claws in crabs. And it was pouring through the literature on all these diverse species where the pieces started to fit together. And I began to realize that there really is sort of a special set of circumstances, like an alignment of the stars that has to fall into place before the intense competition of sexual selection ends up in an arms race. And you end up getting these species with these crazy structures. Hmm. And I can go into more detail if you want. But what was really astonishing for me was realizing that there's all these different kinds of animals with weapons, so different from little tiny flies on a rotting log in the forest in New Guinea to, you know, mammoths or mastodons. I mean, you couldn't pick species that are more different in the essentials of their biology. Hmm. Yet when it comes to the weapons, it turns out it's exactly the same circumstances that seem to sort of spark an arms race.
And does it always come down to the duel, the fight?
I think it does.
Yeah.
And that, there's a fun twist there, too. As I started researching all these crazy stories of animal weapons, my editors kept saying, hey, you got to look at human weapons, too. And I remember my first reaction was, no way. I'm a biologist. I can't be writing a book on military history. But I took their advice and I started reading, and the more I dug, the more astonished I became that the biology of human arms races is really, really similar to what we see in animals. And this idea of duels actually came from the military tradition. It was from reading writings on arms races in our own military traditions that this crucial single step, this idea that rivals have to confront each other one-on-one in a duel, that missing piece fell into place. And then I had the chance to turn back from the military literature to the animal world, and it worked. That same single missing piece seemed to be the catalyst, if you will, that sparked arms races in all of these different animal species.
You traveled around the world to gather data and stories about animal weaponry. Give us a sense of your travels.
Well, I should start out by saying I spent a lot of time in the New World tropics studying dung beetles. And here I can sit here and write a book and talk about Irish elk and mastodons. But the truth is I spent a lot of time in the rainforest studying beetles that are about the size of an eraser on a new pencil. So they're not 10 feet tall with 15-foot long tusks. They're little tiny beetles. But when you look at them closely, they've got a beautiful pair of horns rising up like antlers on the back of the heads of the males. And so I spent several years in Panama connected to the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, sort of looking at their behavior and figuring out how the males use their horns and why only some of the males have the horns, because lots of the males in these populations don't even bother to produce horns. But since then, we've gone through parts of South America. We've looked for beetles in Australia. We've looked for beetles in Africa, in Europe. We've gone all over the place tracking down these weapons. Mm.
In the book, you describe a mass of 100,000 beetles, I think it was, that left quite an impression on you. Tell us that
story. And I'm actually not exaggerating. That really was what it was like.
Yeah. What happened?
So that was on a field course that the University of Montana teaches every few years in East Africa. And it took a while to get the permits. They don't like you hopping out of vehicles in the Serengeti and these national parks because it's not so good for tourism if tourists get eaten. But they were great. We had armed guards standing on the hood of the trucks as we'd go out there and start poking around in the manure looking for these beetles. And there are hundreds and hundreds of species of dung beetle in Africa with so many kinds of weapons.
And what happened? What were they doing? What were the beetles doing there as they were crawling around, 100,000 of them?
Well, so they're all coming in for the dung as food. I mean, that's the simple answer. And so what we did, we found fresh elephant dung in the road right in front of us because these elephants had brushed right by us. And being good biologists, we hopped out, grabbed the dung, put it in a Tupperware bin and brought it back to our campground. And then right at dusk, we sort of set this out on the moist soil next to the edge of the camp. And a whole bunch of us sat in a ring, students in the class, and we all had our headlamps on. And I had clipboards out and I was going to start taking notes on all the different species that came in. But they started coming in so fast and in such ridiculous numbers that it was impossible. I mean, I couldn't write on the clipboard. I was having to sweep an inch of beetles off the surface of the clipboard. And they were sort of plonking down the backs of our neck, is in our hair. bouncing off the headlamps. Mm. They came in so fast. These guys are all coming for the food. And so all of these different individuals representing probably 100 different species are all converging on that same pile of elephant dung at the same time and carving it up and trying to stash it away and get it away from everybody else. Mm. And it ended up being really important. It was one of those sort of special moments when the biology started to click, was realizing that the dung beetles have different strategies for doing that. And that was already known. I mean, you can pick up an ecology textbook that talks about dung beetles and competition, and they'll tell you that about half of the species carve these balls and start rolling them across the surface of the mud. And this is what most people think of when you think of a dung beetle. If you go to Africa and you look at the dirt near dung, you will see beetles pushing these big globes of manure away from the pile. That's a strategy to get the food away from the source and away from all the competition fast. And then there are other dung beetles that nobody notices because they fly into the dung and then they start digging a tunnel underground and they burrow like miners underground and they disappear. And it turns out those are the beetles that had the story when it came to the weapons. It was only the beetles that dug into the tunnels that actually had the horns.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about animal weapons, animal arms races, and you can join the conversation. Have you ever wondered how it makes sense evolutionarily for an animal to grow those massive antlers, horns, and tusks? Wondered why some animals have them and some don't? Here's a Discovery Channel documentary, a part of it, about bighorn sheep, showing the animals dueling with their massive horns.
Lunging at 20 miles an hour, they collide with 800 pounds of force. Double-layered skulls reinforced with heavy bone struts and shock-absorbing air pockets protect the brain from the massive collisions.
We're joined this hour by Doug Emlin, author of Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. Doug, what kind of conditions need to be met for these animal weapons to evolve?
So you need to have intense competition in the first place. So there has to be a premium on winning fights. That's condition number one. But the other crucial ingredient, this thing that we mentioned a minute ago, is this idea of duels. And the reason that duels matter is that not all fights are won by the male, the bulkiest male, or the male with the biggest weapons. If you think about it, there are lots of things that fight in the air. So cicada killer wasps have these vicious snarls in the air as they're tangling around each other in flight. And for things like that, agility and speed matter a whole lot more than bulk and strength. And for the dung beetles I mentioned that roll the balls, they fight all over the place. They pile on top of each other and three, four, or five different males will pile in and push and shove and try to steal that resource and get access to females by doing that. Those kinds of fights are scrambles, and there's no place to lodge yourself or to brace yourself or to push or pry. And so weapons wouldn't help in those types of encounters. But if you fight in a duel, and in particular in the dung beetles, if you're inside a tunnel, which is essentially a tube, a male can brace himself against the tunnel walls and lock his legs. They've got big spines on their legs, and they push into the side of the walls and brace themselves. And then they can use their horns to pry and twist and push at a rival male. And so in the confined space of a tunnel, you only ever have to face one rival at a time, because only one male can fit into the tunnel at a time. And he's always going to come at you face to face. And it becomes a pushing match. And the bigger, stronger male, and often the male with the biggest weapons, wins. Mm. So fights happen all over the place, but only certain types of fights result in a situation where bigger is better. And when you get that kind of a situation, intense competition for access to females, and a style of fighting where bigger weapons win, that's when you can be off to the races, because any type of advance that makes a weapon bigger or stronger or more complicated is likely to sweep through a population and win, essentially. And then any other advance that comes along after that sweeps through the population, and the populations start on this trajectory of sort of evolving to bigger and bigger and bigger sizes. So it takes special conditions having to do with the nature of the fight to spark an arms race, so to speak.
On the other hand, what are the evolutionary costs to the impressive weapons that you talk about? When does a weapon, be it an antler or a tusk or a fang, become no longer worth the resources?
This is the big magic question, because these things can get very expensive. And a number of biologists have spent quite a while trying to calculate just how expensive these things are. So there have been some beautiful studies on species of deer, like moose, that have shown that males have to leach out incredible amounts of minerals, phosphorus and calcium, in order to build the antlers. And they have to actually pull these things out of their own skeletons in order to build the weapons, because they literally cannot get enough of it from their food. So these animals are forced to go through a seasonal form of osteoporosis and be brittle and weak-boned exactly at the time of year when they have these huge weapons on their heads and they're smashing into each other in these dangerous battles. In the beetles that we've studied, sometimes males will have to shunt resources during development into the horns at the expense of other structures. So in some of these species, a male with really big weapons has tiny testes, and he has smaller eyes and smaller wings. And these end up being a pretty steep price to pay in order to be able to win fights and have big weapons. Mm-hmm. So the real question comes back to, when is it cost effective? When do the benefits outweigh the costs?
Let's get a caller in here. Jake is in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Jake. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the effect of trophy hunting on animals and whatnot. Does the fact that humans are harvesting the largest and best animals have any effect that we can see on, you know, deer population and the size that the deer is and the size of their horns? I can take the answer offline.
Jake, thank you for calling. Douglas.
Sure. And this is an issue that I think people are starting to pay more and more attention to, because, of course, I mean, the backstory behind that is that these things are so costly, they become so expensive to produce, that almost all of the males in a typical animal population can't afford it. Only a very small subset, the biggest, the best, the healthiest, the most robust, dominant individuals, those top condition individuals, the very small fraction of them, are the ones that can afford to produce the most spectacular manifestations of these weapons. And the organizations like the Boone and Crockett Club exist to keep records of these incredible, gorgeous animals. They do that because these animals with the biggest weapons are so rare. They're special. And so you have this paradox that those are the animals in the wild who, under normal conditions, are going to be by far the most reproductively successful. They're usually the highest genetic quality, the highest overall quality. They're the dominant individuals. They're the ones that usually secure access to the females and do most of the breeding in a population. But those are also the same animals that hunters most prize. Mm. They look incredible, and they're really rare. And you put those two things together, and there's essentially a price on the head of the biggest, most spectacular bulls and bucks. Mm. And there are some studies coming out now. Some colleagues of mine here connected to the University of Montana have done long-term studies on bighorn sheep populations, for example, and they've been able to show that 20 years of hunting and selectively trying to get the biggest male rams has, in fact, applied selection, if you will, to these populations, pushing antlers or horn size, towards smaller and smaller sizes. And they've actually got evidence now that these populations are evolving in the opposite direction. So the typical pattern of sexual selection is driving the weapons towards bigger sizes, but hunting pressure is now pushing these populations back towards smaller weapon sizes. And there's been quite a trend over the last 20 years of the biggest rams having smaller and smaller and smaller weapons. Mm. And that does appear to be an unintentional effect of trophy hunting.
Mm. Let me bring another voice into the conversation. Vicki Constantine Croak is with me in the studio. She reports on animals and wildlife for WBUR Boston's The Wildlife blog, author of Elephant Company and The Lady and the Panda. Vicki Croak, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
What are you hearing in this conversation?
Oh, I'm fascinated by everything. And Doug, I love your book. It's phenomenal. For me,
Can I quickly say, Vicki, I loved the article that you wrote on the Craighead brothers. I live in Missoula, and the Craigheads are heroes out here, and that was a beautiful piece that you did.
I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you. My trophy animal is, unfortunately, the elephant. And those tusks, as we all know from the unprecedented slaughter of elephants today for their ivory, where in the olden days, elephants could live a very long life. Their tusks, they continue to grow throughout life. Their tusks continue to grow. And some trophy tusks from long ago, the turn of the last century, can be about 400 pounds, 200 pounds each for the tusks. So they put a lot of that biological energy into that. And the other aspect of elephants is that they go into a period called must. So even the elephants who don't have the biggest weapons are suddenly, they can be the deadliest males among them. And in this period of must, which takes place about once a year, their testosterone levels rise 50 to 100 times normal. Mm. I say to people in the audience, imagine yourself or a man in your life experiencing that. It's very costly to them. And one African bull who was in must for 6 months lost 1,000 pounds during that time.
Mm. Mm. Douglas Emmon, respond.
That's incredible. So I have actually been bluff charged by an elephant bull in must. I know exactly what you're talking about. And these things have exactly one thing on their minds. And elephants are a great example of the intense competition that males in some animals experience over access to reproduction. The female elephant spends so long investing in any particular breeding event, up to 4 years between the pregnancy, a 2-year pregnancy period, and then a 2-year nursing and maternal care period during which they're not reproductive, that you end up with this stunning asymmetry with lots of males out there able to breed at any point in time and very, very few females that are actually receptive at any point in time. Mm. And the result is just stunning competition. Mm. And elephants are also great, I think, in the context of the question I just fielded about the effects of hunting. You're right. You have to go look at museums if you want to see the full splendor that our African elephant species used to have in the size of their tusks. You won't see that out there on the landscape anymore. They're just not out there.
Let me get another caller. Oh, excuse me, Doug. Let me get another caller in here. Mary in Smithfield, Virginia. Mary, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
This is a fascinating discussion. I didn't hear it from the beginning, so if you've already commented on this, I apologize. But I haven't heard you mention the influence of female mate choice on the evolution of this weaponry. And it's been my understanding that females preferred the males with the largest array of these appendages, and that they, in fact, do contain clues to the fitness of the male. Would you comment on that, please?
Mary,
thank
you.
I sure would, and you haven't missed anything. We haven't talked about that one at all. So if you look across the diversity of animals, and in particular, if you look at these extraordinary structures that I'm so obsessed with, so the really bright colors and displays on males or the big weapons on males, you tend to find groups of species where females are actively choosing among possible mates. And those tend to be the species where you get really spectacular displays. The males will have crazy calls or huge tail plumes with bright colors, and they'll do these elaborate dances. Or you find animal species where the males just battle it out directly amongst themselves to be sort of at the right place at the right time. And those are the kinds of situations where you tend to get really big weapons. So usually the weapons are there primarily because the males have to have them in order to fight to get access to females. But you hit it on the head. These things are big, expensive, conspicuous structures. I mean, you can't look at these species and not be blown away by the weapons. It's the single most overpowering aspect of their entire morphology. These tusks or horns or antlers are stunning. Mm. And they're honest. They're so expensive to produce. As I said a second ago, only the biggest, best-conditioned males can actually produce the most extravagant versions of these structures. And so in a lot of these systems, the weapons may have arisen originally as pure weapons in combat. But in a number of these animal species, females have figured it out. It's like there's this big, obvious thing sticking off the head of these males, and it tells me a lot about the quality of that male. Mm. And so there's really nice studies in some ungulates and in fiddler crabs in particular where females pay a lot of attention to the weapons, and the males will wave these things up and down and up and down, and sometimes the claws will be really brilliantly colored. So you have something that is first and foremost a weapon, but it also has beautiful color patterns on it, and it serves at the same time as a display.
Vicky,
so no, that's a great point.
No, it is. Thank you, Doug, so much. Vicky, we were talking earlier about the amount of energy that goes into mating in the wild.
So, Doug, one of the things that I was interested in is the one way we can measure the spectacular expense of reproduction and the antlers that the elk have is that you compared it to what a female goes through pregnant and then nursing the baby. And I'm curious about the gender differences in the amount of expense that the males have in growing their armaments as compared to the females who every time are the mammals in particular who are pregnant and raising young.
Yes. So usually the simple answer is that almost always females are the ones that are investing the most in reproduction. And that's part of the reason that males end up having to compete with each other, is that if females are investing a lot of time and resources in a given reproductive event, they're sort of out of commission. They're not fertile or receptive. And that means that only a small subset of females can breed at any one point in time. Because the males are not investing as much in reproduction, they're sort of ready to go a lot of the time. And you can end up having lots and lots of males out there, able and ready and willing but not on a female's. And that's the backdrop for competition that drives all of this. Hmm. So when these people started figuring, and I didn't do the work that you're talking about, estimating the cost of the antlers, but I was blown away by this literature. When the people did these studies and they found that by their calculations, these antlers were costing males as much as it cost a female to raise two offspring to weaning. Hmm. That blew a lot of us away. That was a big surprise. Hmm. I can go into a little detail on how they did that if you want,
I'll say this first, Doug. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Actually, I'd like to ask you about piranhas, because that's another interesting piece of your book. Tell us how it is that piranha teeth are able to feed on prey so much larger than themselves.
Sure. And so the simple answer there is they're able to do that because, unlike so many fish predators out there, they don't swallow their prey whole. And so this barracuda do the same thing, and they also have really impressive teeth. They can go in and rip a hunk off of a bigger prey item and literally grab a hunk of flesh and tear it off. And that type of a feeding strategy lets them start to dig into things that are bigger than them. Most predators, most fish predators have to actually open their mouth and swallow a prey item whole, which means you have to have a bigger body size and a bigger mouth than the things that you're eating. But these few exceptions like piranha sort of break that rule. But I want to step back, if I have a second here, just to point out that most of the weapons I've been talking about, and it's true, most of the ones that I stay awake at night thinking about, are weapons that usually are in males, and they arise in this context that we've been talking about called sexual selection, where the males are using them in fights with rival males to get access to females. But there is a whole other realm of weapons out there that sometimes get really big, and those are weapons that are involved with prey capture and predation. And so the piranha are a neat example of that type of a weapon. And at first, when I was going through the literature and pouring through all these sort of case histories of these crazy weapons, these predator weapons were a problem. I mean, it was a square peg I was trying to fit into a round hole. They didn't fit. And it was a real problem for me for several months. I just couldn't figure out how to explain why some predators would end up having really big weapons. And it was actually the saber-toothed cats that were the missing piece that clinched that story for me and made all the parts of the story start to fall into place. Mm. Because I was absolutely convinced that the saber-toothed cats had to be a sexually selected weapon, that the big fangs were in the males and not the females. But nobody was talking about that in the literature. And I finally ended up talking to paleontologists. It's like, surely these things are sexually dimorphic. These are weapons that are used by males. And they'd say, no, females had them too. There was no difference in the size of the teeth between these things. They weren't used in sexual selection. And it was finally pouring through these papers. I found this little section in the end of one of these papers that described studies of the musculature and the bone structure of these things. And these scientists had concluded that these were stocky, heavy animals that could never have run fast. There was no way they could have chased down prey. They just weren't built for it. And their best guess at this point was that these were ambush predators, and they probably hung out on branches of trees and dropped onto lumbering juvenile mastodons or mammoths and stabbed their fangs into the necks of these things from above. And that was it. That was the missing piece. It's like, wait a minute, they're ambush predators. Ambush predators don't have to run fast. Mm. They don't have to swim fast. They don't have to chase down prey. And so it doesn't matter if you carry a big, heavy, bulky, awkward weapon. All you do is sit there and you snatch something when it comes by. Mm. And when I started looking at predator weapons, they all fit that same pattern. Praying mantises with their big forelegs, even, you know, things like piranha or things like fangtooth and the viperfish and the umbrella eels, these deep sea fish with huge mouths, they're all ambush predators.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about animal weapons, tusks, horns, fangs, antlers, and beyond. Here's some sound from a documentary by a wildlife photographer capturing a brutal fight between two bull African elephants.
Masaku was trying to twist the older and heavier Dionysus off his feet. Then he could tusk him in his side.
We're joined this hour by Douglas Emlyn, author of Animal Weapons, and by Vicky Croak, who reports on animals for WBUR's The Wildlife blog. Doug, tell us the story when you were in Belize as a graduate student, when some trap jaw ants came to your rescue. What happened?
We'd been in the field. This was a field course when I was a graduate student at Princeton, and we spent several weeks down in the forest in Belize learning about biology and about the tropics. And we'd been out in the in the bush, so to speak, that day, and I had a machete sort of strapped around my belt, and it was a cheap machete with a really cheap plastic sheath, and we were all hot and tired, and we'd been covered with rain, and we found this beautiful pool that we were going to go swimming in, and I was trying to take my belt and my pants off to jump in the water, and I was talking to somebody else, and I was distracted, and I remember grabbing the sheath of the machete and just pulling it away from my belt, but the handle of the machete had caught on the edge of my pants, and I didn't notice it because I was talking to somebody, and I ended up drawing the machete across my thumb as I pulled the sheath away. And it was such a cheap plastic sheath that the blade cut right through the sheath and sliced into my thumb to the bone. Mm. And there we were in the middle of nowhere.
Right, and so the trap jaw ants came, and what happened?
It was the army ants. It was the army ant soldiers have huge jaws on their heads, and if you put them up against you, they clamp their jaws shut. And you can pop the body off the head, and all of a sudden you've got a makeshift suture. And I'd heard people talk about doing this. I never expected to have to actually do it. But there we were in the middle of nowhere. So we poured rum into the cut to sterilize it, and then I had people take the army ants, and we would hold the wound shut, and they'd put the head of the ant there, and the ants would clamp down and close the suture. You pop the rest of their body off, and the head stays locked. And it worked really well. The problem was as I'd walk or do things for the next day or two, I'd end up swinging my arm and I would brush my thumb against my pants and it would rip all the ant heads out and we'd have to do the whole thing again. So we ended up having to wrap the whole thing in gauze. But no, it worked like a charm.
Hey, it's just like a regular emergency room visit, sounds like.
Field biology is what you got to do.
Vicki, tell us about the so-called cheaters in the wild.
One of the things that I loved about your book, Doug, is, of course, the ones who game the system, the males who game the system and don't grow the big armaments but figure out a way around it. And one of my favorite stories from Jane Goodall is that this is not a biological cheat, but it was a behavioral one. And there was a very small male named Mike in her group at Gombe, and he was low ranking, very low ranking. He just didn't have the muscle to be one of the big guys. But one day he accidentally hit one of the empty kerosene tins that was around camp, and the noise scared away the other chimps, and he quickly became alpha male, and he capitalized on it. For some reason, the other males didn't catch on that they could do it too, but Mike, whenever he was in trouble, and he would sometimes gather the cans, look directly at the alphas or the other males, threatening them with these cans, and then he'd just bang them together, and the noise of the kerosene cans just catapulted him to the top.
That's a great story, and it worked. So he was able to stay the alpha male for a while.
He did.
Let's get another listener in here, Adam in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Adam. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. I'm enjoying the show a lot so far, and I was wondering if we could go back to the predator-prey relationship and cover the other side of that, where the animals may have developed these mechanisms of defense. And also, I'm a little bit curious on how animals might develop weapons as opposed to physical structures, and I was wondering if you've encountered that in your research at all.
Adam, thank you. Doug.
Yeah, that's a great set of questions. And so there's sort of two parts to that. There are a number of ways that animals sort of escape predation or fight back in one way or another. And it's true, I haven't spent as much time focusing on that because, as I said at the outset, I have this problem. I'm obsessed with the extremes, and the really, really big stuff usually doesn't evolve in the context of defensive structures. But there's some beautiful examples of armor plating that you see on everything from little pill bugs to extinct trilobites to pangolins and armadillos. Nice examples of armor plating that has arisen presumably because it helps protect these animals from being chomped on by predators. And then chemical weapons are a whole nother game. And there's some fun examples. One of my favorite examples involves both a physical protective structure and chemicals, like hedgehogs. We all love to keep these as pets. They look so cute. They've got these stubby little spines on their back that are actually fairly sharp. And they are really good at using chemical weapons. They can't synthesize their own toxins the way that lots of other insects and animals can. But they're really good at finding poisons in their environment and essentially ingesting them or sucking them up in their mouths and mixing them with their saliva. And then they'll take this frothy poison mix and smear it all over their spines. And so if you keep these as pets and you happen to be in an apartment complex where somebody comes in and sprays in all the corners for roaches or something like that, you'll find that your pet hedgehog walks along the edge and licks the corners where they sprayed all this poison. And then they'll froth it all up in this white foam that looks like shaving cream and smear it on their spines. And you look at them and they look disgusting. So you pick them up to clean them. And as you reach down, they jump and they pop up off the ground and they stick you with their spines. And now they've punctured your skin and injected roach poison. Mm. It's actually a very effective combination of chemical weapons and structural weapons.
It's incredible.
But the truth is chemical weapons are fairly different from the types of structures I've studied. And I don't spend a lot of time talking about them. They behave differently and they appear to evolve quite differently, in part because they're not always as expensive as the big bulky tusks and antlers. But great question.
Let's go to Wayne in San Mateo, California. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for allowing me to join the conversation.
Of course.
I'd like to take us back, if you please, to a point that was made earlier that these weapons often extract a very large price on the creature. I think the examples were demineralization of skeletons or osteoporosis in the case of antlers, and also very small male genitalia. Might there not be parallels between these mechanisms, if you will, or consequences, really, and the consequences that societies or nations pay in developing huge military weaponry capabilities, and at the cost of other services in that society, such as crumbling infrastructure or poor educational systems? Mm.
Wayne, good question. Thank you, Doug.
I couldn't have said it better. You hit that one spot on. There is incredible evidence that when these, especially when you get arms races and you start getting extreme investment in weapons, there's no question that the cost just gets higher and higher and higher. And I think the example that's going to ring the most true for most listeners, and also one that's really well documented, are the costs that were tied up with the Cold War. In the context of what we talked about earlier, the Cold War also was a duel, if you will. It ended up as sort of a one-on-one throwdown between two superpowers or two coalitions of states. But the costs were stunning. And it's difficult to estimate these things, and people, you know, use different formula. But no matter how you look at it, there's really no question that in both the Soviet Union and the United States, all kinds of other aspects of society suffered because such a high proportion of the discretionary budgets of these countries was being allocated to the weapons. Mm-hmm. So huge parallels there. There's no way around that one.
Here's Dan in West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Hey, how you doing? The previous question really went in the direction I wanted to go in. I want to request that your guest clarify the division between his understanding of the development of weaponry as a natural process and the development of weaponry for humans as a cultural process that involves decision making. I don't want it to be left unsaid that I don't want the way that humans develop weapons to be folded into a natural process. I don't think that's a good idea, and I'd like to hear what he has to say about it.
Dan, thanks. Doug.
Yes. So first, let's make no mistake here. I mean, I am a biologist. I work on beetles. So I'm so far out of my comfort zone when I start getting into these parallels, and that should be hopefully transparent and evident from the outset. And I don't want to imply that there are no decisions involved in these things that and that those decisions don't matter. But what I will tell you is that I study animal weapons. And as I sat there laying all these cases on the table and I started comparing what was going on and what kinds of circumstances would spark an arms race in an animal weapon. And once it was sparked, what would happen? How that arms race would unfold, what sort of were the stages or the steps along the way, and what kinds of things would bring about a collapse of the arms race. And then I started looking at historical documents, looking at arms races in human military technology, and there's no escaping it. The parallels are stunning. And so, yes, at some level, the conclusion is, wow, despite all the best decisions of all the brightest minds in the age, these weapons are doing exactly the same thing that the weapons in the animals are. The parallels are real. What we can infer from those parallels, you know, I don't try to make any judgments in the book, and I'm not trying to go anywhere specific with that. What I really do want to get people doing is thinking about what it means that the trajectories of evolution of human weapons have such striking parallels with the trajectories of the evolution that we see in animal weapons. I can say one thing that is important to say here, that when we talk about evolution and performance and success in animals, I'm talking about reproductive success. So the winners in the game, if you will, the males with the biggest weapons, they win because they have the highest reproductive success and they contribute the most offspring to the next generation. When we talk about manufactured weapons, it's a different currency. It's a different comparison, if you will. We're not talking about the people with those weapons have the most offspring. What we're really talking about is the success or failure of the weapons. Are they cost effective, and do more and more people or more and more organizations or more and more nations begin to adopt them? And is there a trajectory of building bigger weapons? Do bigger weapons outperform smaller weapons on the battlefield or the playing field or whatever the arena might be? So we're talking about a different set of currencies here. It's not reproduction. But we're still talking about a selection process because some weapon designs work really well and other weapon designs don't. Some of them are expensive. Some of them aren't. Sometimes those costs are justifiable because the payoffs are worth it. Sometimes they're not. And there are really bright people out there trying to design weapons that work better than what's out there. Yeah. And that process, when you look at it, has real parallels to what we see with animal weapons.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let's get John in here from Mansfield, Connecticut. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Oh, hello. What a fascinating discussion. I followed your work for a long time, and I happen to work on periodical cicadas, our loud eastern insects. And I wanted to get your thoughts on acoustical weapons that animals use in sexual selection or in other functions.
Thanks, John.
Wow. I might have to turn that. I love cicadas, and I love acoustical displays. So there are lots of examples where males will use an acoustic signal as a display to attract females. I've never thought about acoustic signals in the context of weaponry or actual direct sort of combat or contests among males. There are beautiful studies of frogs calling or lots of cricket songs where males are out there singing as loud as they possibly can. And there's good evidence that these songs are expensive in the same kinds of ways that the antlers or horns would be expensive or fancy displays on birds would be expensive. It's often energetically expensive. It's dangerous because you're out there calling and predators can home in on the same signal that the females can. And so for a male to get out there and sing is for a male to risk death. And actually, in some of these systems that have been really well characterized, the risk is huge. I mean, a huge number of males get killed or eaten because they're out there giving this dangerous call. Mm. But I'd never thought about it as a weapon. And if you have, I would love to hear how that works.
Excellent call. Thank you so much. I got to get this sound in here. This is a video filmed in South Africa that's recently gone viral. A lone porcupine fending off a pride of 17 lions while showing its spikes and rattling its tail.
That must hurt.
I can just envision that. Doug, what's happening there?
Wow. I can envision it, too. And I haven't seen the video that's gone viral.
You can actually watch it at our website, onpointradio.org.
I will do it as soon as I get off air. I'm going to guess that what's going on there is that porcupines have a very elaborate defense capability, and it's a defensive set of weapons, and these are the quills. And porcupine quills, especially the African porcupines, are really long, rigid, sharp structures with barbs and hooks on the ends, so they can stick you, but they also pull out of the porcupine, so that a lion that sticks his nose into a porcupine is going to get a whole bunch of quills lodged into its nose. It's going to hurt. They pull back, and these quills come out with that and end up sort of hanging off the face of the lion. It's a very effective and painful way to keep lions back. But usually there still are predators that are able to get past it. So
Becky,
I'm surprised
that
many lions couldn't do it.
Well, the problem, and there's no lion hospital out there for the lions. So even if they can take the porcupine down, they're going to be injured in the process, and those injuries could be severe. That's the interesting thing, Doug, I think about those weapons, is that you just need enough to get someone to not want to bother with you. It's not worth the price of admission. Doug?
Yeah, I agree. That all of these structures are sort of shaped by a history of selection that really is a balance between costs and benefits. And so I completely agree. If it's enough to deter a predator, then there's no sense in investing in more. And that's really the issue of trying to figure out when the arms races start. For so many animal weapons, you don't really need a big structure. Any old weapon will do. So what are the circumstances where that delicate sort of tug of war between costs and benefits gets tipped so that all of a sudden bigger really is better?
Let me ask you in our last minute here, what do you want us to know out of this conversation, Vicky? What was most fascinating to you?
I was fascinated by the whole thing, and I'm interested in from the that there are males obviously are the ones who do the investment in the armament. And we didn't have time today. Doug, I was going to talk to you about spotted hyenas and how the females are bigger and their investment in having more muscle through having more testosterone, among other things, and how that fits into the picture. But that'll be for another time.
What do you want us to know, final parting words about animal weapons, Douglas Emlyn?
Wow, parting words. I think the thing that blew me away the most was realizing that despite all these crazy species and all these different habitats, the central biology of their weapons is really the same. And given the comments that we had from the listener that called in with concerns about what it means when we apply that logic to people, I still think we have to apply that logic to people. I think we have a responsibility as scholars and citizens to think about these things. And if those parallels really are that striking and that real, there's a message there. Not 100% sure what it is, but there's a message there, and it's worth thinking about.
It's a terrific book. Doug Emlyn, professor of biology at the University of Montana. His new book is Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. Doug, thanks so much for your time. Good luck.
Thank you. This was fun.
Vicki Croak, thanks to you. Vicki Constantine Croak reports on animals for WBUR's The Wildlife blog. So great to have you sitting in here with me.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.